So Laura Jaramillo is a poet and critic born to Colombian parents in Queens, New York. She now lives in Durham, North Carolina. Her books include Material Girl and Making Water on Future Poem 2022. She holds a PhD in critical theory from Duke University, co-runs the North Carolina-based reading and performance series Paradiso. Jaramillo read as part of Green Space in spring of 2023, and it was a revelation. The poems were like electrical storms glittering with charges spraying through their nodes. Or is it that they were having a surgical sense of the image, presenting moments in language pulsating with life whose edges had been scalpeled away, then arranged in an impossibly precise geometry, the vibrancies of life, what tightly circumscribes its conditions? Or were they a kind of x-ray vision where skin and bone, material and ideological, were presented as simultaneous transparencies through deft pivots of language? Either way, the work totally captivated my attention. Thanks so much for visiting us at Green Space, Laura.
Thank you so much, you guys. Thank you, as always, Joe, for the incredibly generous, critical, sharp introduction. That in itself is a gift.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, we're doing our best here. So we're going to start with our first question, which I understand may be a hard one. What is the best thing that happened to you this week?
Let's come back to that one.
Absolutely. Well, then, Jake, it's all yours.
Okay. Yeah, we'll move in an entirely different direction.
Cool.
Another one of our questions, and this is one that we've kind of carried forward from some of our previous list of questions, and that is, Laura, what do you think of machines?
What do I think about machines? Feels like we're in a really kind of troubled relationship with machines in our culture at this point in time. I think machines can be fabulous and can, you know, free us from work. We're always at risk of losing the human. I'm not a person who is free from anxiety about losing the human. And I think we just haven't really learned to use our tools or our machines properly. And we end up thinking that the tool or the machine is life and is everything. And we don't protect what is valuable about what our brains can do and what human culture can do. Sorry to be very serious.
No, I think that's great. I think that sort of thinning out of our capacities via our relationships with these technologies is a really important consideration. Given that that answer was sort of about the horizon of our relationship with technology and machines, maybe we can think about the future a little bit. And this question comes from Bernadette Meyer's list of journal ideas and writing experiments, where she asks, what is the poetry of the future? Or we could think of this as the writing or medium of the future as well.
Yeah, I love that question. I mean, I think it's hard to know whether, poetry has persisted across the centuries. And obviously in its origins, it's closer to music and then became more committed to the page. And so it's hard to know, it will probably evolve, and the way things are going, it'll probably evolve into a more visual performative medium than like the codex. It seems pretty inevitable. It seems like it's already happening. But I think, you know, there's like a question of like the poetry reading audience who buys the book buying, the like middle class book buying audience, which is like almost like fake at this point. Like we don't know who those people are. Those people are like us, and we're not middle class, you know, we're like precarious. But then there's like also just the question of like, do people does the average person have a feeling for poetry? And I would say that on the latter count, like I think that everyone has the capacity to understand poetry, and that's what makes it so that like it'll always exist in some form. And like, you know, we're not, I think mediums like TikTok and stuff are just really, and you know, probably the platform TikTok itself will die and something will come and supplant it. But like, we just don't know what that capability is. But for me, I mean, I can sort of like, so I think there's that speculative realm. And I'm always like really tied to arts that are kind of like dying. Like I love film, and that's like an allegedly like art that doesn't, that's not going to like exist. That's like always going out of business, like is not worth it, is not profitable. And as is poetry. But I guess like I can, there's things that I can see in current poetries that point towards the future for me. And, you know, I think like one of my, you know, in writing my latest book, Making Water, I was really interested in, you know, bodies of literature on synesthesia, like both in film and in literature, and even more kind of scientific stuff on synesthesia. And I think that like, there's an element of like, and I don't think that I'm like the only one doing this or anything, but it's like, to me, I think there is a kind of bridge between like, you know, the codex form of the book and a more kind of futuristic thing of, you know, poetry being on TikTok or something. And that is poetry that thinks about the condition of extreme mediation, and that thinks about synesthesia, because synesthesia is actually just like a native property of mediation. And so to me, that work is really, I mean, like I'm like really excited by the work of Lisa Robertson. I always have been. I'm like, I'm a longtime fan, but like what I kind of see in that work, even if, I mean, I don't know to what degree she feels herself to be like thematizing this, is like, you know, kind of like, to me, that work feels like it's very much determined by like trying to map subjectivity as it is displaced across like technologies and architecture and clothes, and just like it's less like specifically media oriented, but like in the way it thematizes itself. But to me, it just feels like really a byproduct of technology itself. And so I'm like really, really interested in work that like hints at that. It doesn't need to like necessarily always be explicitly theorizing that. But I think that work that is touched by that question is for me a kind of interesting bridge, and it may be the bridge that actually makes poetry as we know it disappear. But it's to me, that's like the generative, interesting one.
Yeah, I love that kind of idea, as you're saying, this bridge between the codex and some more futuristic, speculative form, hinting at both this form of mediation and also our continued commitment to some sort of material form, tracing out these kind of shifts and adjustments across technological and, you know, material substrates that kind of carry poetry forward. So I'm also interested in these kind of threads and the shifts or the tensions between those two types of things, in particular with thinking about those materials, and especially when we're talking about books, that I would imagine for all of us here talking, they have held a really important place in our lives as objects. And this question actually came from Jay Bessemer, from who we'd interviewed last year. And this question is, what is an object that has had a powerful meaning in your life?
An object that has had a powerful meaning in my life. I mean, for me, the most, the objects most charged for meaning with me are my clothes. Like I really have always treated clothes as kind of a costume. And so much so that like people don't necessarily like recognize me from one context to the other, like, and I'll be like, hey, and they'll be like, who are you? But like, you know, when I think about the things that most are like invested with kind of memories of my life that mark periods of my life that are kind of associated with like the costume of an era of my life, they're my clothing. And like, you know, even my mother was very, I mean, my mom's alive. She's not as interested in clothes as she was, but when I was young, my mom was like very, very fashionable and kept like a really large archive of clothing. And we were always moving a lot and our lives were like really chaotic. And so she was always like, she was always in some kind of like tragic relationship to like lost clothing and like lost objects. Like someone, like she accused one of my dad's friends during their divorce of like stealing her Crown Victoria, which was like this like boat of a car with like blue velvet seats. It was like two blue velvet couches on wheels. And so there was just like always this like kind of like intense attachment and mourning for material things. And so like, you know, I have a lot of stuff. I love antiques. Like my house is like literally crammed full of antiques, but I don't get too attached to objects, but I get really, really, my clothes are the objects that mean the most to me because they mark my identity in a certain period. And it's also really interesting to me because then that like I'll start to wear something totally different and that identity will kind of like flip and go away. And it's just like, yeah, wow. That was like, it kind of moved in and out fast, or it took years, you know, like I'm still attached to so many things. So I still have clothes from, I've always been like an avid vintage shopper and also like an avid like trash picker. And I still have a lot of clothes that I got out of the trash in New York when I was like 15. And those are really important pieces for me. And I don't know if I'll ever like let them go.
Amazing. Yeah, I love the idea of indexing like moments in one's life through clothes. I immediately thought of the fact that many of the clothes I wore as a kid were sewn by my parents or by my mother. Yeah. And this jacket I had in high school that had like a Grateful Dead and a Pearl Jam patch on it because I was really trying to like figure out who I was through music and clothing.
That's so cute.
Yeah. No one was there to introduce me to punk. But so thinking about, you know, clothes as costumes, the changeability of them and evanescence, not in a very particularly like explicit way, but in an intuitive way, this brings me to Danica Stegman LeMay's question, which is, can you talk about what you do with dreams?
Interesting. So full disclosure, my dreams are like incredibly tedious. I'm like a very, very anxious person. And I have like a few autoimmune diseases and a lot of, there's just like a weird link between autoimmunity and not like sleeping very well. And so, especially when I'm like off sleep meds, I dream about like being at work in an awkward situation, like super, super not exciting, like just obvious anxiety dreams, or like dreams that are so on the nose Freudian that they're like silly, like, oh yes, that means that you like, I don't know. But I think what I'm interested in actually is, I think that my daily life is much more dreamlike than my dreams themselves. And full of like really strange coincidences and like psychic messages all the time. And I mean, like, actually there's whole periods where I just feel like I'm like just receiving messages and it's actually like too much. But I think in like, as it relates to like my poetry, especially like in earlier work that I wrote, there's a more obvious kind of like hypnagogic thing where it's like, it's always kind of drifting back and forth between sleep and dreams. And I was very, as a young writer, like Alice Notley was extremely influential to me, like just super important. And so, I think that was, something that I really took from reading a lot of Alice Notley early on. But, you know, I think I'm still really like, even if the kind of more obvious, like mise-en-scène of not being asleep, not being awake in my poems is not as apparent anymore, I think it's still always there. Like, I think that I am interested in, operating in my poems in like a space that's kind of like between like history and memory and dreaming and waking. And, you know, it particularly like that historical dimension, because like, I'm really, obsessed with, the last, like the history of the last 20 years. I mean, probably Joe, I'm not sure what age you are, Jake, but like Joe and I think are around the same age. And it's like, you know, 9/11 was the formative, event of our, you know, coming of age. And, for me, something that like kind of continually obsesses me is just like how memory hold, the 2000s, like the 2000s were. Like, we don't remember George W. Bush being president. We act like, the only thing that ever happened was Trump, and have kind of like, I have noted the culture, slowly being less and less able to like piece historical events together. And that's almost like, for me, that's a kind of dreamlike state. And so I'm kind of interested in like a state of receptivity where those things can come into play. And for me, that's like a kind of dream space, which is a false dream space actually, but it's somewhat closer to, it's even because it's somewhat closer to waking life for me. But yeah.
No, that's great. I think this idea of living and drifting through a form of dream space, and also as that, using that kind of as a method of meaning making and sifting through both. I think if you're thinking of this as like a blurry space, right, where certain things are obscured through that process, but also there's, as you were saying, this kind of receptiveness, and there's the like too muchness of endless messaging and information kind of pouring out at us. And it made me think a little bit of some of the ideas. This sort of maybe ties back into with ideas of thinking through poetry as a form of music, and this shiftiness between music and also the use of silence as a kind of really important element in the space of the poem, and this other space of noise and noisiness. And Dana Venerable had the question, like, what is noise, or what do you think about noise?
Noise, very, very capacious question. You know, I think for me, I like noise. I both like noise and I kind of refuse it. And you know, I think that in the same way that there's a tendency for the brain, like if you think about like, you know, parataxis is like a pool of words together and the brain wants to like make sense of them. I think that there's a very analogous thing with noise. It's like a bunch of noises together or like a continuous noise. Your brain just wants to make that into music, which is also something that I like have reflected on through going to like a lot of noise shows in the last like 10 to 15 years. It's just like, you know, like noise is so much like your brain just wants to make sense of it. And so I think like kind of going back to what I was saying in the previous question, it's like, I'm, you know, I tend to think a bit more visually, but I think sonic in my own practice as a writer, but I think like sonically, there is like this kind of collaging like I always, you know, write things that people tell me and I kind of like write them into different contexts and like also try to capture the, you know, the sonic landscapes that I perceive to be a part of, you know, the daily life in which like the poem is set. But it's all of that is like almost like, it's kind of like denoising it and turning it into music. And that's, maybe it'd be cooler if I would just let it be noise, but it's like, I have a real resistance in letting it be noise.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I mean, I think, and that's one of those eternal push and pulls for the artist is that negotiation of order and chaos and their role in it. And so, you know, I think this might be a useful place to think about, you know, as you're talking about your process and you've talked about the hypnagogic and the synesthetic and the processes of denoising art. And I guess, you know, this leads me to Mike Correa's question, should art be useful? And maybe a way to connect it to what you were just saying is, you know, do those processes of or imperatives that you follow in putting a poem together speak to how you imagine its use or circulation in the world?
Yeah, so that's like a really hard one, I think. I mean, I guess I'll say like, I'm a Marxist, so I think art should just be a little bit useful. Like, it's like, I'm just like not an art for art's sake person, like ever. It's really hard for me to get on board with that. But do I think that art should be fully useful? Like, absolutely not. That's a nightmare. it's actually a nightmare for me to think of art as having like full utility. So yeah, I think art should be a little useful. I don't necessarily believe that, you know, art, like obviously there's like a lot of ways to approach social reality through art. And I do like in my own kind of like aesthetic preferences, I like art that expresses some obligation to social reality, but maybe not total obligation to social reality. I could talk about it in a lot of specific contexts, but like at the end of the day, like if I'm just giving a straight answer, a little bit useful.
I think that's a great answer.
I'm here for it. Yeah.
It gives enough space for kind of art to emerge in the various forms it will, while still having some sort of stakes to it, right?
Yeah, and I just think that, like, you know, I mean, one of my things that I've done in my life is study a lot of art, and specifically a lot of political art, and I think that the ambiguity is still just a really important quality for me. Like, ambiguity is just something that I aesthetically can't let go of. And I feel like maybe also ethically can't let go of. And we're also like in a weird time where like people are kind of trying to instrumentalize everything and like make everything useful. And like sometimes for really good, like people who mean extremely well, but I just don't, I think that it's important to keep a quality of ambiguity, like the best. I can't think of any art that I really love that doesn't have some kind of ambiguity in it.
I think that's a really important kind of aspect, especially if there is an interest in some sort of utility, also maintaining that sort of ambiguity as a threat alongside it feels really generative. I'm thinking of maybe questions that resist particular forms of utility and very clear sense making. I love this question that comes from Allison Carden, which is, Laura, what's up with the moon?
The moon. I'm a person who's very affected by the moon. I get insomnia on full moon nights, and partially that's because Cancer is the ruler of my chart. So I'm like very fully in relation to the moon, but I also feel like the moon is kind of a mysterious entity and that we shouldn't fully know it, and that we definitely should not mine minerals from the moon. That's one thing that I feel strongly about. I'm for maintaining the moon's mystery.
Okay, yeah, another question I can get on board with. Yeah, deep sea mining and moon lithium fantasies are not where it's at. So I don't have a great transition from that question to this one. So I'll just move into it. Kenning JP Garcia asks, what books of non-poetry were important to you as a poet?
So when I lived, so I'm originally from New York City, and I went to college upstate, and then I got my master's in Philadelphia, and then I came back to New York in my late 20s. And it was an interesting world in New York during that time, which was like kind of 2008, circa 2008 economic crisis, because I found that there was no real way of like fitting into the poetry scene. It felt very like alienating. And at the time I lived with a translator and ended up moving very much in translation circles. And because of that, I was introduced to the work of Roberto Bolaño when it had just been translated. And the first, I read some of the shorter novellas before reading The Savage Detectives, and I was really affected by it. But The Savage Detectives was just like really, really monumental for me. And really important in kind of like connecting me to like a history of Latin American poetry. Because up to that point, you know, I'm Colombian, and you know, my parents came from a very like intellectual milieu in Colombia, where most of their friends were like writers and artists, but I was very separated from Latin American writing, and very separated from what that would look like. And the book, The Savage Detectives, gave me like a whole world to like really imagine and think about that was different from the Anglo poetry world. Maybe not everyone who is listening to this interview will have read it. And so The Savage Detectives is about a group of poets based in Mexico City who are trying to find a member of this older generation avant-garde group. And the book turns into a murder mystery, but along the way, there's a lot of like political intrigues between poets, border violence, lots of stuff like that. But it just opened up a world for me, and was really, really important and remains really important. And it was really funny because last year I was like invited to a literary festival in Argentina. And at the suggestion of a friend, the people who invited me run this leftist magazine called Rapallo, and they're on the pretty like militant left, but there's obviously other scenes in Buenos Aires. And there was this party of this magazine that was like recently relaunched, and they had a special issue on Wallace Stevens. And so there was like a lot of Argentine poets like reading work inspired by Wallace Stevens. It was very like, and they were all like, it was funny. It was like a very kind of like fae social scene. Like they were like wearing Smith's pins, and it was just strange, like in a lot of ways, and kind of boring. And there was this Chilean guy there who, like my phone kept going off because when I was there, they had tried to like kill the president of Argentina or the vice president of Argentina, like the night I got there. And it was a huge to do. And there were like, the streets were flooded with people supporting her because she's kind of like the head of the left in Argentina. And so there was like, and also the Queen of England died the same day. And so there was this like, celebratory clip on Argentine TV that was like, I was trying to load to play on my phone that was like, this fucking stupid old lady died. And it went off during the reading because my WhatsApp was so slow to load. And so as soon as I opened my phone, this like, you know, in the middle of this like very serious reading, this clip went off that was like, the fucking stupid old lady has died. And so it happened twice. And at a certain point, like the people who were running the reading were like, do you have a problem with us? Are you trying to start something? And this Chilean guy stood up and was like, I just wonder why Latin American poetry, which has historically been some of the most revolutionary poetry in the world, is occupying itself with something as boring as Wallace Stevens. This is extremely depoliticizing. And it was really intense because it was like someone in the audience, like standing up to the editors of this magazine, which is a magazine with like a long tradition in Argentina. And, you know, they were just like kind of the mainstream literary establishment being like challenged by this guy. And it was triggered like accidentally by me. And it was just this, anyway, it was this really interesting situation that made me just be like, wow, the Savage Detective is real. Like people fight over literature and it means something, and we're part of a history and we're part of a tradition. And so it's just, yeah, it just formed me. I can't even describe how much it formed me.
Mm-hmm. That's so incredible that the novel can capture the way in which the stakes of poetry are real and echoing in life in ways that sometimes might remain elusive to poetry within certain networks.
Cool. Okay. This next question comes from Tim Liu. Is Jacques Derrida once remarked that what we want to know most about philosophers but never ask in interviews is their sex lives? This is the question I want to ask poets as well. You're welcome to, you know, answer the question, or it's actually a statement, right? Or to interrogate it and maybe ask some more questions or around it, whatever you feel most interested or compelled to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like, I take the question to be sort of like, is there an analogous relationship between poetry and sex? And I think there is. And my short answer is just that like, it's poetry is a specific relationship between people, as sex is a specific relationship between people, and the pressures of the literary market sometimes make it seem like there's one poetry for all. But as anyone who's, you know, had sex with someone who's supposed to be like a hot bitch and it feels really onerous and awkward, it's like poetry is a specific relationship between specific people.
Amazing. Yeah, that's so compelling as a form of relation that's also, yeah, cathected by like normativizing forces, really plural. Okay, so Laura, that was our 10 questions. But I did want to circle back to the first question to see if anything has arisen.
Now I remember. Last night I saw Killers of the Flower Moon, which I really liked. The new Scorsese. Oh. I'm a big fan of the movies. I'm a big fan of Scorsese, and I just really liked it. It's long. It's 3.5 hours, and it's about this. It's about the Osage tribe in Oklahoma being kind of systematically murdered for their oil money, and about a white guy who marries an Osage woman who's wealthy and is involved in the killing of her family. It's interesting to see Scorsese kind of like work on like native stuff. I'm sure that there can be many critiques made, and I'm really interested in like hearing what Native American viewers would have to say about it. But there is like a, it's just really beautiful to see that culture narrativized in kind of mainstream cinema, which it's usually not. And, but it's also like a gangster film. Like with Scorsese, it's like, he's just like, he'll like give you the razzle dazzle. Like, it's just like, it's kind of comedic. It's kind of a gangster film. It's kind of an epic tragedy. It's kind of a like a historical epic. All those things coexist. And I like that quality, and I had a nice time. So that was like definitely the nicest thing that's happened to me this week.
Okay. Amazing. Well, Cheryl and I are going to be getting in line hopefully in the next week.
Yeah. I really do recommend it. It's a really good, and also for his late stuff, like, I mean, The Irishman is like horrendous. I think The Irishman is a little bit of a travesty. Like, this is a real return to form.
Mm-hmm. That's really good to hear. I mean, I remember, yeah, being in my 20s and loving Scorsese, but then trailing off, yeah, as his later works came out. All right. Well, we could talk about movies probably a lot, but yeah. But I do want to, before we close, ask, you know, for anyone listening, is there a place they should go to check out your work, and or are there projects coming out that they should look for?
Yeah. So I, my website, which you can include in the show notes, is essentially just a giant archive of my writing. And it includes just stuff like old books that you can download for free, and like movie reviews that I've written, and kind of cultural criticism interviews that I've done. So if you're, there's poetry there, but I'm interested in like a lot more than poetry. So it's like, if you're interested in like, you know, film, Marxism, like cultural theory, stuff like that, it could be exciting for you. And I'm working on a kind of diptych to Making Water called Burning Sequence. That I'm hoping there will be a little chapbook version of soon, although I don't have it nailed down who's going to do it, but that's what I'm working towards. So maybe it's like a thing where if you read Making Water and you're like excited about it, then look out for Burning Sequence in the future.
Amazing. Yeah, I love Making Water. So any publishers listening, maybe Mike Correo, make it into the chat book, please.
Call me up, baby.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Laura, thanks so much for joining Jake and I at Green Space. We really appreciate it. This has been
fantastic. Thank you so much for having me. It was so good to chat with you guys. I hope that life brings me back to Buffalo soon, because I have a huge soft spot for Buffalo and its poets. So thank you so much, y'all.
Yeah, thanks for chatting with us. We'd love to hang out again.
Oh, my dog
peeking out. Hey.